invitation to this beautiful place and to this interesting conference. I want, or maybe I should talk. I want to talk about not the foundations of quantum physics, but about some applications of quantum physics to very natural questions which are not, say, at least not treated in standard textbooks of quantum physics. And this concerns certain observables which are very fundamental, like the time or the space-time localization of events. And it's not so obvious which how these observables are represented in the framework of quantum physics. Now, the plan of the talk is the following. I will first discuss the construction of an observable which describes the time when a certain prescribed event happens. I will then generalize this construction to the construction of an observable which describes the localization of an event in the Minkowski space. But then I will do something more fancy, namely I will try to use the same principle for some more speculative version of space-time called the non-commutative Minkowski space, where one has taken into account certain uncertainties of space-time, which one expects from the from the effects of quantum gravity, and we'll see how, in which sense, then this space-time is stable under this principle of which that developed before. Now let me just start with some general remark. As we heard also yesterday, one of the big problems in the quantization of gravity is that when in gravity we consider space-time to be an observable concept. But if you look at, say, and of course it should be subject to the laws of quantum physics, but the best theory we have at the moment is quantum field theory, and in quantum field theory, space-time is used as a parameterization of fields, but not as an object which can directly be observed. So it's used as an a priori structure which we have to know in advance, and then we can formulate our quantum field theory. Now, actually, the same problem we have on a much smaller scale already in usual quantum mechanics. And in usual quantum mechanics, time plays an important role, but it is not considered to be an observable inside quantum physics, but it's just a parameter. And I made a check in textbooks of quantum mechanics. What they tell us about the measuring of time, and the answer is zero. Even the famous time-energy uncertainty relation you find in pre-quantum physics textbooks for experimentalists, but for the real quantum physics textbooks for theoretical physics, there's almost no mentioning of the time-energy uncertainty relation. Okay, now to get some feeling what the problem is, one might first look at this corresponding problem in classical mechanics. So we cannot just say we want to measure time, we want to need some device how to measure time. So we look at some observable parameterized by some function f of the phase space, from the phase space, and we ask then at which instances of time this function takes a value zero. This would be a definition of a time observable, but you see it from the definition, it's not clear that this gives an instant of time. There can be a whole interval of time, there can be several instances of time. So the definition of this time observable will depend on the choice of the function capital F. Let us look at a simple example. So we look at free motion in one dimension, and the event which we want to use for determination of time is the moment when the particle passes through the origin. So the time evolution is given by this simple formula, x of t is x plus p over m times t, and then we can solve this equation and find that the time observable associated with this event is minus m times x divided by t. Now we could do the same thing now in quantum physics. So in quantum physics, we would prefer to have an Hermitian operator, so we take the symmetric combination of the products before. So we have p to the minus 1 x plus x times p to the minus 1 multiplied by minus m over 2. And actually, this operator was proposed for different reasons, so far as we were aware of, by Aharonov. But this operator has a problem. It's not self-adjoint. And just to convince us that it's really not self-adjoint, we can write it on momentum space as this differential operator written here. But because of the inverse of the momentum appearing here, cannot be defined on all tests, on all elements of the Hilbert space, but only on functions which are differentiable and which vanish near the origin. And then you find that this operator is not essentially self-adjoint, which can be easily seen. You just look at the adjoint, and you solve the eigenvalue equation for the adjoint. You find this two-parameter family of solutions. This is a Heaviside function. And there's a parameter mu, which is related to the eigenvalue by this formula. And you clearly see that these functions are normalizable if the real part of mu is smaller than zero. So you see that you have deficiency indices 2, 0, and so the operator is maximally symmetric. There's no self-adjoint extension. Actually, this is a general fact. There cannot be any time operator which transforms in the right way under time evolution, which is self-adjoint, if the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is different from the full real axis. This is a theorem first proved by Pauli. I will indicate the proof of this theorem, which is different from Pauli's proof, but which sheds some new light on this theorem. Namely, let let t be a time operator characterized by the fact that it's self-adjoint and that it transforms covariantly under time evolution. Now let p of I be a spectral projection of this operator for a finite interval I. Then we look at the time-translated projection, and this becomes orthogonal to p of I for large t. But this means that this operator valued function written here, p of I e to the I ht p of I, has compact support. So the Fourier transform is an entire analytic function. And on the other hand, the Fourier transform vanishes outside of the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. So there are only two possibilities. Either this projection is zero, or the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is a full real axis. So there cannot be any projection characterizing the instant of time. So the way out is well known, at least in this audience. Instead of using self-adjoint operators, we look at positive operator valued measures. And we see in addition that these positive operator valued measures must have the property that this product of two such operators, P of I and the translated operator, is not allowed to vanish. Yeah, if the support of this function would be compact, then we would run into the same problem. So there's no sharp distinction between the time interval where this event happens and the time interval where the event cannot happen. Now, actually, several examples of such positive operator valued measures are known, and I might refer to article of Bush and collaborators and references therein. And what I want to present here is a slight variation of this, namely what we call the time of occurrence observable, which was presented in a paper by Onmeo Onetti and myself a few years ago. And so why is time of occurrence easier than time of arrival? This is connected with the fact that the concept of time of arrival involves some irreversibility. And to find irreversibility in quantum physics is always a little bit tricky. But time of occurrence is completely harmless, as we will see. So let's describe the situation. So we have a system described by a Hilbert space and a self-adjoint Hamiltonian. We choose one positive operator A, which is an effect in the terminology of Ludwig, which describes the event which we want to use for our marking the instant of time. Now we look at the behavior of this operator under the time evolution. It integrates over some interval I, operator B of I. Now if A represents the probability that the event happens at time equals zero, then this operator B of I, this integral, can be interpreted as the expected time the event lasts within the interval I. And then the natural question is, can we look at the limit where the interval tends to the full real axis? So this would be the total duration of the event. And this looks at the first sight as a complicated technical problem, because this is if we start from a bounded operator A, but if this interval tends to the real axis, we will end with an unbounded operator. And it's not so clear what a good notion of convergence is in this case.
Do you make any assumptions on the spectrum of the Hamiltonian?
Not at the moment. This will turn out that this will work only if the spectrum is absolutely continuous. But at the moment, it's completely free. Yeah?
No, but there's no bound. Like you're not assuming it's bounded below or anything like that.
At the moment, it's only assumed that the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint. Not more. But we will see that we will find intrinsically some restrictions. Okay, so let me first discuss this technical point of looking at this limit. So what saves us is the positivity of this operator A and of course also of this operator B of I. So we look at the resolvents of these operators, which are positive operators, smaller than one. And if the interval increases, the operator C decreases. This operator on the right hand side decreases. And we can just look at the infimum of this operator. And this is again a bounded operator, which has a spectrum between 0 and 1. Now we come to the decomposition of the Hilbert space H according to the spectrum of this operator C. Namely, we decompose the Hilbert space now into the direct sum of three subspaces, H0, HF, and H infinity. What is H0? H0 corresponds to the eigenspace of this operator C with eigenvalue 1. If you express it in terms of this operator B for the replacing the interval by the real axis, then this corresponds to the fact that the time the event lasts is 0. So the event does not happen at all. That's certainly a subspace on which our concept of using this event for time measurement is not very useful. Yeah, so this really has to be excluded. Then there is this eigenspace H infinity, which is the eigenspace of C for the eigenvalue 0, which corresponds to B of R being infinite. Because infinite is not a good value for an operator on a Hilbert space. So we have just to exclude this subspace of the Hilbert space. And in this subspace, the physical interpretation is that the event lasts infinitely long. Although then, it's certainly not good to use this event for introducing a time observer. And so we end up with a certain subspace, HF, which is the orthogonal complement of the direct sum of H naught and H infinity. And on this subspace, the inverse, this operator B of R, exists as a positive self-adjoint operator, and it has a densely defined inverse. Everything can be expressed in terms of this operator C. Then our C, restricted to the subspace, has no eigenvalue at 0 and no eigenvalue at 1. It has spectrum inside the open interval 0, 1. Yeah, but the boundary points of these eigenvalues are not, spectral interval are not eigenvalues. So the inverse exists as a densely defined self-adjoint operator. And on this subspace, this operator B of R can be interpreted as a total duration of the event. Now we use this framework to define a positive operator value measure, and we do it by what we call operator normalization, which is the following. So we have to find now a positive operator between 0 and 1, which has the usual properties of a positive operator value measure, which is interpreted as a probability that the measured value lies in the interval I. And the construction is the following. We use this operator B of I, we defined before, and we normalize it by multiplying from both sides with the minus the square root of this operator B of R. So this is a well-defined bounded operator between 0 and 1, and it has obviously the property that if I tends to the full real axis, this goes to 1. And it satisfies all conditions of a positive operator value measure. And let me describes this in more detail, how this operator looks like. So we assume now that our Hilbert space can be represented as an L2 space on the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. The L2 space with respect to the Lebesgue measure, so this means that we assume that our spectrum is absolutely continuous. And this energy spectrum can be degenerate, so the degeneracy is characterized by this multiplicity Hilbert space. And then we can express the energy, the density of this measure in terms of the integral kernel of this operator A. And the explicit formula is given here. So we have the integral kernel of A, appears here. Then we have the total integral of A of t. And if we perform the total integral, then this involves the delta function of the energy. So it's multiplied then just with the diagonal part of this integral kernel, which is -1/2 from both sides. And the time dependence is the standard time dependence here. So it's a very explicit formula that you get this general principle. And it works provided these integral kernel of the operator A is sufficiently smooth. So there's some technical assumption here to write it in this form. But this is not crucial. This is just a presentation as an integral kernel. But what What is crucial is that the spectrum must be absolutely continuous. Otherwise, it would not be true. Yeah, that's not work. Now, usually observables are not characterized in terms of the measures, but in terms of subatomic operators themselves. So if you have a positive operator that you measure, you can also look at the corresponding first moment, because this does not characterize the positive operator value measure completely, but at least it gives some indication. So we can do this also here. So we have this integral of the measure, this the first moment of the measure. And if we do this calculation, we find that it's what we expect anyhow, namely it's the derivative with respect to the energy plus some function of the energy, which takes values in the operators in the multiplicity space K. And so this we could have concluded at the beginning from covariance consideration. But what we learn here is what the interpretation of this additional function dA of A is. This contains information from the choice of the event A. Let us look at an example. So we look again at a particle moving freely in one dimension, and we take the event that the particle stays in the neighborhood of the origin. So the event is represented by the projection onto the symmetric interval around the origin, which has the length A. And now we can compute this corresponding operator B, which we had before. This was a B corresponding to the full real axis. And what we compute is, this is given by this prefactor, which is just the length of the interval divided by the velocity, and then it's multiplied by this factor, which contains the parity operator. So we see that for large A, it gets a classical result, that the time is just distance divided by velocity. And for small distances A, we get some correction depending on the parity of the wave function. So we see for a wave function with even parity, the tendency is to stay longer at the origin, actually twice the classical value. And if the parity is odd, then there's a tendency that this goes to zero, as we expect, because the wave function vanishes at zero for an antisymmetric function. Now, if we now construct our positive operator value weight, it does not reduce this operator normalization, which means that all the odd wave functions contribute to this. Actually, we have to take the inverse of this operator, so we should not take the limit A to zero before we construct the measure. So we have first to construct the measure with a finite A, and it's, then we can do the limit A to zero, and we find this density for the operator value measure written as an integral kernel in momentum space. So it has a very simple form. And we can then, to close the argument, compute the corresponding time operator. What we find is nothing else than Aronov's time operator. So just gives some support to this principle of operator normalization. I must admit, I have no operational justification for this operator normalization. So we did it because it worked, looked plausible, but what it really means operationally, I don't know.
By your operational normalization, you mean that multiplication by b to the minus half?
And yeah. So we weight the contribution to this observable according to the time which the which is the inverse of the time the particle spends in the region. Yeah? So if it spends less time, then we give it more weight. So this seems to be the correct way of doing it, but okay, I don't have an operation.
Can one mimic this classically, this calculation?
That's a good question. I should have thought about this before, but
just a calculator there.
I think it's very very natural question. I don't know the answer.
Very quickly, here's one other example that I'm familiar with where this kind of an operator normalization has been used. And again, no particular interpretation could be given, or I wasn't able to give it at that time. This is years ago when we were studying with Eng the localization, a possible localization operator for the photon. And you know, there is a problem because if you have photons in one box and another a different number of photons in another box, and if you suddenly remove the partition between the box, then the total number of photons is not the sum of this plus the sum of that. Okay, it's not additive. So the Yao and these people had a positive operator that would not measure, but a set of positive operators to describe this thing. And in order to go to a measure, we did something like this. There was a normalization, very similar to this, but we couldn't find an interpretation for that. At that time, we said something like the probe renormalizer of the photon field or something like that.
But that's very interesting to know. So you can give me the reference. Okay. So this would be very nice. Because that's actually a point where we did not really make progress. So it's, the applications work. We've tried also a lot of other applications. Everything seems to be okay. But one would like to understand it better from the operation point of view. Okay. Now I want to come to the second part, namely to the corresponding construction of an observable which measures space-time localization on Minkowski space. Actually, it's almost the same. So the difficulty is at another point here. So we start, instead of starting from the surface of Hamiltonian, we start from the existence of the unitary, strongly continuous representation of the translation group. And we again choose some positive operator, which is the event which marks the space-time point. And we can find again the same, make the same construction, construct this decomposition of the Hilbert space into the three subspaces, and only on this space HF we can use this event for marking the space-time point. And we get an operator valued measure which associates to every region in Minkowski space some positive operator. And P of X is the density of this measure. The difficulty here is to find good examples. And we have only one example which really was worked out. Namely, this is a free scalar field on Fock space with mass m. And now this looks a little bit dangerous. We use as our event the event that two particles meet at the same point. So A is the annihilation operator. A particle at the point x, ax squared means that two particles are exactly at the same point, and a star x squared is then, okay, this annihilates two particles at the same point, it creates a again, so if the particle is at this point, nothing happens, and if not, this state is annihilated.
So those little rays are not operators, but distributions?
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a dangerous part of the argument, so if you want to be sure that you do something reasonable, you should replace, you should smear these annihilation operators with some test function. Yeah, but it turns out that this is harmless, so I omitted it here. But you could do it easily. But it's similar to what I did before. This is I first looked at a finite interval, and at the end I squeeze the interval to a point. This is a little bit delicate, but here you can do it from the very beginning. So it's okay, so these are the annihilation creation operators. And okay, now we want to perform this decomposition of the Hilbert space. So we have to ask in which subspace of the Hilbert space the event happens that two particles meet at a point. And you can analyze this in terms of the relative angular momentum, namely if the relative angular momentum is non-zero, the particles will never meet. So we look at a certain subspace of the two-particle space, so we restrict ourselves to the two-particle space because this is, I think, a good space of states for these two-particle collisions. And the turns out the space where this is finite is the space of S waves. And now the space of states of S waves is isomorphic to the L2 space on certain subspace of the subregion of the momentum space, which is just the set of all momenta which are above the two particle mass shell and with positive energy. So these are all possible momenta of the two particle system, and because of the restriction to S waves, the multiplicity is exactly one. So the space of these states is equal to the L2 space on this. And it's not only equal as Hilbert space, this would be a very poor equivalence. They are equivalent as representations of the translation. So I can do the full, the same analysis and restrict myself to this space, which is, of course, now I have a formula for the density of the corresponding operator volume measure, which looks very harmless. Yeah, you see, I see this is a wave function as a function of the momentum. I take just here the Fourier transform. And the only new phenomenon which appears is that I do not integrate over all k's, but only over k's in the sub-region of the momentum space. So this is a positive operator value measure. Now we can again look at the operators representing coordinates. So this will be the first moments of this measure. And okay, it turns out that these are nothing else in this representation as the derivatives with respect to the momentum, as we would expect. But of course, these are unbounded operators, so we have to fix the domain. And it turns out the domain consists of functions which vanish at the boundary of this subregion. And these operators are not self-adjoint again. And so what we get is, if we look at the space spanned by this measure, it's not Minkowski space. What we found as our physical positions, physical space-time, or measurable space-time, is not Minkowski space, but it's something non-commutative which might be called the triplet quantization of Minkowski space. So we get from quantum physics some non-commutativity into space-time just by the principles of operator theory. Okay, so that's the situation on standard space-time. Now, many of you will be aware of the fact that during the last 10 years, a lot of interest was in non-commutative space-times and question whether one can do quantum field theory in a non-commutative space-time. The motivation for looking at non-commutative space-time were different. some, actually this was my motivation, was this expected uncertainty from the effects of Brennan gravity. And so one simple model of such a non-commutative space time is a model that will replace the usual coordinates of Minkowski space by elements of some non-commutative algebra which satisfies computational relations of this form. And in this simplest version of this model, this theta here is just a constant symplectic form. Now we can, on this such a space sum, we can define free field theory. That's quite easy. And one can then try to, in this new quantum field theory on a non-commutative space sum, one can now try to repeat the construction of before, defining an intrinsic space time. And as a use again a positive operator, and okay, this is a little bit symbolic. We look now at the annihilation operator evaluated at this non-commutative point Q. Yeah, this looks a little bit symbolic, but it has a precise meaning. So what is A of Q? A of Q is just the momentum space annihilation operator, the standard momentum space annihilation operator integrated with the Lorentz invariant measure on the mass shell, multiplied with this exponential function e to the I k q, where q is now this non-commutative coordinate. So these are just the usual Weyl operators. And so this is the definition of A of q, and then this makes sense, which is written here. Now the one can then construct this general this linear combination or this continuous linear combinations of these Weyl operators into the IKQ. This is the Weyl algebra corresponding to these symplectic forms theta.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
I have asked this question to other people also in particle physics, but didn't get an answer. Isn't that just the Weyl commutation equations?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so, okay, so you are basically just working with the Weyl algebra.
Yeah. No, it's just, actually, this is the attractive feature of the model that you can use everything you know from usual quantization theory just directly translating it. Into this framework. Yeah, so you save a lot of time. You do not have to do all calculations again. Okay, here are the Weyl relations. Yeah? So these are Q is this non-commutative coordinate, K and P are momenta, but momenta considered in the usual sense as C number levels. And then here you have this oscillating factor involving the symplectic form theta. And this describes the deviation from the, it's just a vibration. And then you can rewrite this in terms of this integral. This gives then the so-called Weyl-Moyal algebra. Now we want to do integrations on this non-commutative space. Now what is integration? Now we have, we want to have measures. So what is a measure on a non-commutative algebra? A measure on a non-commutative space corresponds to a positive functional on the algebra. And we restrict ourselves to a set of positive functionals which are smooth in some appropriate sense. Which means the following: if we evaluate the functional on this Weyl operator e to the IKQ, we get a Schwarz function. So this is just a restriction and gives a nice family of states. Okay, then we want to perform this integration. Now we have this elementary effect. A, we want to integrate it over some region, but of course there is no notion of a region in a non-commutative space. But instead, we evaluate it with such a positive functional omega. And I've written here the explicit formula which comes out. This is involved because we have four annihilation creation operators. It involves four integration of a mass shell. Here we have the creation and annihilation operators depending on the momenta k1 to k4. And then we have the evaluation of these exponential functions in this positive functional omega. And the only effect of the non-commutativity is the fact that if I perform this product here of these exponentials, I have to obey the Weyl relations. If I would omit this, then I would just get the function of the sum of these momenta and would be back to the commutative case. Now again, I restrict my considerations to the two-particle subspace, and I again find that my subspace corresponding to a finite space-time volume of the effect is isomorphic as a representation of the translation group to the L2 space on the same subset of the momentum space. It's not the space of the space HF is not the space of S waves, because these symplectic form breaks the Lorentz invariance. But it's isomorphic. Yeah? So the multiplicity does not change. Okay, now we can compute the integral kernel of V of omega. And turns out that it has this very simple form. You get the expectation value of the product of two such Weyl operators. And now K and P are both elements of this subset of the momentum space. And this function C here in front is completely unimportant. It's a positive function, and it will vanish after I do the normalization. So I don't have to give it the explicit formula for C. Okay, now I want to perform this limit because I want not to repeat this operator normalization. So I want to perform the limit where I take the integral of the full space. So what is the integral of the full space on a non-commutative space-time? Now, the best candidate is to use a trace. And actually, this Weyl algebra has a trace, namely the trace given by these formulas. If I write my element as an integral of these Weyl operators with some test function f, then it's just the evaluation of this function at the origin. This is easily to see from the Weyl relations that this satisfies the condition of a trace. And if I realize these Weyl operators as operators on the usual Hilbert space, it's just the usual trace. But it's a purely algebraic construction. Now, when I have a trace, I always have a map from operators to functionals, and from positive operators to positive functionals, by this form, by this formula. Yeah? So I have a positive operator t, and I associate to this operator a positive functional omega t by just using this trace. Of course, it needs the fact that the trace is positive, as I did not mention, but it's a positive trace. And then the limit where I want to go to the full space corresponds now to the limit where the operators t approach the unit. And I can do this same construction as before. I evaluate my operator b with a function of omega t at 1, takes the inverse. Now, if I increase the operator t, this operator will decrease, and then I take the infimum over all operators t, which are between 0 and 1. This defines the operator c. And I can then associate an operator to the trace functional just in the same way as I did it before, I take the inverse of C sub prime 1. It was just the inversion of this formula. Okay, and again, I construct a positive, I construct now not the positive operator valued measure, but the generalization of a positive operator valued measure when the starting space is not a commutative space. So it's a completely positive unit preserving map from an algebra into another algebra. And it's given by this formula. To every operator T, I get this operator P of T defined in this way. Okay, now this is a map which is defined in positive operators, but it's easy to continue to a linear map on all operators. And so in particular, I could also apply it to this operator W of F, which was a quantization of the function F. And I again write down the integral kernel of this operator, which turns out just the Fourier transform of F at the difference k minus p, so this x like a convolution operator. But there are two modifications. One modification is this twist here in the exponent coming from the y relation. And the other restriction is the restriction to this subset of the momentum space. Yeah, so it's it's a sum deformation of our original structure. Again, I can try to define the non-commuting coordinates. I can now associate to the non-commuting coordinates, which are elements of this algebra, or better, they are affiliated to this algebra. Can associate to this now non-commutative quantum coordinates, which are obtained by applying, so this is this Q hat mu, obtained by applying this operator P now to Q mu. And again, they look as I expect, they are the derivatives with respect to the momentum, plus some additional term involving the momentum and the symplectic form theta. And again, I have to specify the boundary condition. It turns out this is a result. Yeah? It's not an input. You find that we need a Dirichlet boundary condition at the boundary. Now, these operators, Q mu, as you can easily see, satisfy the same commutation relations as the coordinates Q mu on a dense domain. If you take the commutator of two such operators, with the partial derivatives commute, and this is a function of p which has to be differentiated in the commutator, you find exactly the commutation relation from which you start. But these operators are again not self-adjoint, and they cannot be exponentiated against the wild relations. The resulting algebra looks similar to the algebra from which we started, but it is not the same. It's slightly deformed. Okay, so that's what I wanted to present. Let me make some final remarks. So we have seen that we can find observables in the sense of positive operator valued measures for quantities like time of occurrence of an event or space-time localization of an event. The typical result is that these intrinsically defined spaces are non-commutative. And even in the simplest case, namely when we have the time observable, and we assume that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is a positive real axis, one finds that the resulting time axis is not the real line, but it's a triplets quantization of the real line. So it's a non-commutative space. Yeah, so we get non-commutative time. And one can ask what is the physical consequence of this non-commutativity of time. And one consequence is that there are new uncertainty relations. So that's an uncertainty relation for time measurements alone, and which is written here. So this is the uncertainty in the time, and it's larger or equal to a numerical constant d, 1.376 and so on, divided by the expectation value of the entropy. And this is slightly more as you would expect from the usual time energy uncertainty relation.
Where does that number come from?
Oh, it's, it comes from the sum zero of the Airy function. So it's so you can map the whole problem onto some problem to define it, to determine the lowest eigenvalue of a certain Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian is just a Hamiltonian which corresponds to a linear potential. You have so imagine a particle moving in the gravitational field of the Earth in vertical direction. Yeah? You have a reflecting boundary. Then you can ask what is the state of lowest energy. And this number comes from this. Yeah? So in this sense, it's an exact number. It's not a numerical calculation. It's just some zero. It's a zero of the Airy function and then some function. Power 2/3 or something, I don't know what they are. Now, if you already start from a non-commutative space-time, then we find a deformation of the given space-time by a completely positive map. And if one tries to get some feeling what one has done, so one can perhaps makes the following interpretation. We know similar situation in renormalization theory, that the theory has bare parameters and dressed parameters. And we here we can think of this space-time from which we started as a bare space-time, which everything was defined. And then intrinsically in the theory, we compute a new space-time. This is a physical space-time. So this could perhaps also help in the conceptual problems of quantum gravity. It seems that we have to use some parametric space-time in order to start with, but the space-time which we see is not the space-time on which we start in the formalism, the space-time which comes out of the formalism. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Well, we have lots of time for questions.
But this can't be a proper renormalization theory because everything is finite.
No. What I did here is, of course, much. No. You can also have renormalization, finite renormalization. There you start with some quantities in your Hamiltonian, and but then you derive from this some physical quantities, and this can be a finite map. So this is not a contradiction.
No, I didn't mean it as a contradiction. What I meant is that to be a respectable renormalization theory, they should be infinitely.
Well, I'm sure if you really do quantum gravity, you'll find infinities as much as you want, much more than you want. So I think that's probably not the problem. But I think the problem is So, for instance, there is this problem with causality. Yeah? We start from space-time, which has some causal structure, but we know that the interaction itself has to change the causal structure just because the gravitational field is quantized. But I think here you see that you should not be worried about the original space-time on which you started. You should only look at the space-time which comes out. This has to be satisfied by a certain causality restriction, but not the parametric space.
There's just one thing I missed somewhere. I mean, for the last part of your talk in this non-competitive space-time, okay, you start with the essentially the Weyl-Heisenberg algebra, right? And then using a representation of that algebra, you're constructing the Dirichlet operators. They should be called the Dirichlet operators. So you're constructing them, but somehow these operators turn out to be, or the generators of that representation, the corresponding operators turn out to be non-self-abstract?
Yeah.
There's something I missed in that whole thing, and why that happens.
Okay, I think it's the same phenomenon that you have seen in the commutative case. In the commutative case, you started from just numbers, yeah, so these correspond to self-adjoint operators, and you applied this positive operator value to weight, and so it maps into a non-commutative algebra. The algebra generated by the positive operator value weight is non-commutative.
So
it's deformed. It's a deformed, you start from commutative algebra, which is the algebra functions of commutative space-time, and you map it to a non-commutative algebra. And if you start from a non-commutative algebra, you get another non-commutative algebra. Of course, one could ask whether there might be some space-time which is stable under this operation. This I don't know. Of course, here this is also restricted by this very special choice of the event I use. For instance, in the interacting case, one could perhaps try to use a Lagrangian to mark the event. The problem is that the total integral of the Lagrangian will not be finite in any subspace. So that's... And you have also this non-locality by using the annihilation operators. Annihilation operators are not local fields. Yeah, so that's, but they are used in order to get some subspace in which this total integral is finite.
I was just wondering, if you start with a non-commutative state, can you ever end up with a commutative state? But that would depend on the event, if I...
It depends on the event, yeah. Okay, I don't have a general answer. I would not expect it, but this is just my feeling. There's no principle. I don't know that that there's any reason why this cannot happen, but it seems very unlikely.
Maybe
that
we do not have it, because if you have this asymptotic complementarity, you take your Dirichlet operators, two of these commute them, and then if in the limit you get the boson back, in some sense.
Yeah.
Then you could say that in the limit you have a commutative saturation.
Mm-hmm. No, okay, might be that it's possible.
It's the usual thing that people do who do Dirichlet quantization. Take this asymptotic limit of commutators and see if it corresponds asymptotically to the post operator.
Another way that one can consider to give a precise quantum. First definition of a quantum measurement of time could be through interferometric measuring phase shift. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you have a harmonic oscillator with a few particles, you try to make a very precise phase estimation in the quantum estimation theory.
Yeah.
And you find a POBM, an optimal POBM.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the best you can do is to prepare the oscillator, the harmonic oscillator event, in a state which is something similar to a squeeze state. And then you have that the optimal phase variance is bounded by a number which is like this one, 1.3, something like that, divided by the number of four, instead of the square root. If you use a coherent state from the oscillator, you have 1/1 square root of the number of four, which is just called the Schott noise.
If you put the harmonic oscillator in a particular kind of squeeze state, you get something like your.
That's very interesting. Since I was looking for the generalization of this inequality for the phase operator, but I could not reduce it to the same to a similar problem.
So your QDM in the case of a harmonic, because your Hamiltonian is free particle, right? If you have a harmonic oscillator, you get up the same.
Yeah.
In theory, you should find the same as an optimal phase estimation.
I think so. Yes. We use this theory. This is as we have done it here, restricted to Hamiltonians with absolutely continuous spectrum.
Right.
But in case you have discrete spectrum, you can do something similar. So in the harmonic oscillator, you have even discrete spectrum
should be easy.
They're all intervals are multiples of each other of one interval. Then of course you can get the time only up to a period. Then you
right.
The time is no longer a real number, but it's say a point on the circle.
Right, up to a period. Right.
Yeah. And then you could just look at similar considerations, and we try to do the same estimate which we have done here. So we have reduced it to the ground state of a certain Hamiltonian, but we could not. We could not solve the Schrödinger equation for this. So perhaps we should have done it numerically, but we did not do it. But maybe this has already been done. So that's. No, it's just a discrete Schrödinger equation, and it's not difficult, it's just that we could not calculate the eigenvalue, the ground state. Because I think it's not certainly possible, but we did not. Maybe there's no explicit method, maybe you have to do it numerically.
Because there's also another way to measure space is through interferometry.
Yeah.
You suppose we have space is changed by some very strong gravitational field, and you have a big interferometer in space, and you see there is a very tiny phase change. Actually, I think this is the way by which satellite build up this general theory of gravitation starting from the measurability of space and time in terms of interferometric limitations.
So I think this should be possible to do it in a quite similar way. It's also possible, this was already done by a diploma student of mine, to do it with a generic discrete spectrum. So if you have a generic discrete spectrum, then of course you cannot do this total integral over all times. This will diverge. Because of revival processes, yeah? You will always return to the same value. Your function is quasi-periodic, is an almost periodic function. But what you can do is you can, instead of, you replace the time axis by its Bohr compactification. And then you get a positive operator valued measure on the Bohr compactification of the real line. And the measurable sets are then not intervals on the real line, but families of intervals on the real line, infinite families of intervals, which just correspond to this phenomenon of revival. And for this, then you get a complete theory of positive operator value measures. What is not so clear is what you can do if the spectrum is in between the discrete case and the absolutely continuous case. Because there are so many possibilities, I don't know what one can do in these cases, and maybe one should do it only if one is forced to do it.
But from the point of view of a theory, I'm talking about things that I don't know, but a theory of a gravitation, quantizing, or at least something which is compatible with quantum mechanics,
You just need to have a good clock, right? So what about just to fix a system which is some anonymous data and use that as a time reference that
yeah.
you really measure?
Yeah, yeah, certainly. No.
So I'm changing the spec. Take the easy spec. Because you have the possibility, you think that maybe changing the spectrum you can have something more precise?
I think it's more the question whether one can understand the time evolution of such systems in an intrinsic way. It's not in the not so much the interest not to design measurement instruments. That's perhaps then perhaps you are right that one should use a simple system. Yes.
Because it's also, it would be interesting to compare your POPF with the phase POPF.
Yeah. No, with the phase POPF, and we compare it.
So is this a very different?
No, the principles are very similar. So,
what do you mean when you say the phase POPF?
because when we say the phase POPF, because there is a huge class of cost function, which is the Hollyhock class of cost function for the estimation of phase shift. And the optimal PVM for this class is the optimal for the largest class of cost function that is known, and we call it the phase PVM. It's clearly not the only one. It's the optimal for the largest class. Don't you agree?
Well, of course, I agree. I mean, of course, all this phase covariant phase, if we take Losty, then all the covariant positive operating measures with respect to the sixth generic has been fully characterized. And of course, within that family, one can single out so called Kananga phase, which is simply the top its measurements.
Is the top, there is a top its operating.
Yes, so. And of course, in each of those cases, one could also derive this type of phase number of time energy uncertainty relation, because the moment operators are easy to compute. And in fact, they have been done. Now I don't remember exactly the numbers which came out. Of course, it depends on the measure.
So this is what we would like to know.
What did you build? Well, there's a doctoral dissertation done on that topic also.
No, but he did not try to use this. So he concentrated on the case of a generic discrete spectrum.
Did you build in some covariance also in your time also?
Has to be covariant at the time evolution.
Yes. Yeah.
That's by definition.
Continue a bit, because you have here non-commutativity in various levels.
Yeah.
But also on the first level, I mean, this operator measure is necessarily probably always non-commutative.
Yeah.
In a very strong sense.
Yeah. So this is this remarkable point.
Yeah.
So non-commutativity is generic.
Yeah.
Can I just make one comment about the terminology? You see, it's unfair to call these things jerklets operators. This term has been hijacked by the mathematicians because Derivian also used them and probably for jerklets. So we tend to call them Derivian jerklets operators.
Okay, maybe.
And I suggest that this be adopted. It was only voted on once in Vienna because Martin Schleschmann started by calling these jerklets operators. We booed him down. Now he also calls them Derivian jerklets operators.
There is a danger that if you apply this analysis also to the momentum operator, the occurrence of momentum, that you get other uncertainty relations between position and momentum than the known ones, with different bounds, whereas the known bounds could be saturated.
The momentum operator I can construct, but this will give itself a chance. This is just a standard momentum operator.
It means momentum localization as the event.
Yes.
Yes.
Momentum. No, no. Of course, these operators depend on the chosen event.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, you can choose an event which gives bad limits. Yeah. So for instance, for this time operator, I could do it in such a way that this operator, this subspace HF, is zero. Or it's completely gives very large uncertainty. If I use, it's just if I take the event, okay, which has a minimum length for 1 day, yeah, then I will not get more precision than 1 day. So this, I think it goes in the opposite direction. Certainly I can do it worse, but if I try to do it as good as possible, then I find this limitation. And it's just as in experimental physics, you can use bad instruments.
Couldn't you just take those computational equations instead of thinking about time and energy, just think about position and momentum and
yeah.
do a similar kind of analysis? You would end up with other bounds on those.
No, I don't think so. I think I would, if I tried to find the optimal bounds, I would just get the standard bounds. I think that's okay. I did not try it, but this is more or less okay. Maybe not obvious, but I have no doubts.
Can I comment briefly on the Pauli theorem that you mentioned?
Yeah.
I think if one reads that footnote in Pauli's book, one gets the impression he is a bit incoherent in his definition of a time observable.
Uh-huh.
In the main text, he just refers to canonical commutation relation between the Hamiltonian and some hypothetical time operator. But in the footnote, where he gives the proof of this no-go statement, he uses basically the Weyl relation. Well, at least the covariance of energy shifts. And that makes the proof work, but that has probably given rise to quite a lot of confusion. And what would you say to someone coming with a construction which has been given of self-adjoint operators that are canonically conjugate in that sense to the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian? And they would say, well, this is a valid time observer, or isn't it?
It's
a bit of a trick question, but we had to face it.
I think the problem, one problem is if you need, of course, to start from the definition. So the definition I prefer here is to say, well, I have a positive operator value weight, or say projector value weight, projector value measure, which transforms covariantly under time evolution. And then the proof stands. It's not Pauli's proof, it's in a sense a dual version of Pauli's proof. If you instead argue with the unbounded operators, then you have a lot of problems. You have to say where, on which part of the Hilbert space the relation should hold it. Which I don't think that there are good motivations for choices, and I don't know whether there are good theorems. But I think it's much better to formulate it in terms of bounded operators. And here you have the bounded operator as a time evolution, the unitary, and the projections, which are also bounded. And then the situation is clear. And I would say, in case you propose other quantities for which you don't have these bounded objects, then I would doubt that this is a good choice. Seems to be very formal then. Yeah? Because with unbounded operators, you can do, I will not say you can do everything. But as Murphy's theorem for unbounded operators, everything which can go wrong will go wrong for unbounded operators.
I'm going to be a bit maybe repeating the same question, but indeed, you consider the first momentum vector of your own.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I guess that it does not have all of these coverage properties. And then your time box. No, the first moment is completely covered by the fact. There's no choice. The domain is completely fixed.
Sure. Yeah, but I mean, as a problem, this perhaps was also involved in Paul's question that if I take that cell as an operator,
yeah,
and I consider it as a time also,
yeah,
then it doesn't have the coverage. If I'm going to the spectral
response,
so maybe one really needs all the moments in order to represent the time box.
This might be. I think it's dangerous if you only use the operator, the first moment alone.
Yes. You mentioned that you were still looking for good accurate justification of the operator number. And you're looking sort of for an intrinsic explanation. But I wonder whether taking a look at an extrinsic explanation might shed some light on conceptual content. So I'm imagining in particular, if you have a quantum system that's like a stopwatch, and if you do a conditioned unitary based on the event you're interested in, and you set the stopwatch running. And then eventually you do a measurement on how much duration has passed
for
this event. And presumably, you'll reproduce the sort of POEM that you've derived here. But maybe along the way, you'll get some insight into why the operator normalization should work.
Other
questions?
Can I see this numerical constant?
Okay,
that's amazing. Because we have a numerical evaluation. 1994 was the beginning of this kind of thing. It's 1.36 plus minus 0.01 with the number of 4.
1.36.
Oh,
it's very similar, yeah? Almost the same.
It's within the error. Including the numerical error.
It's
the same within the numerical error.
Ah, yeah. But this was for this phase operator.
The current, right.
The optimal phase estimation. Nice. And by which method this was?
Just the quantum estimation theory provided. I'm sure this can be evaluated analytically, but we were very weak in the beginning. But the number is the same.
That's not fun.
Probably this estimate is also in the old paper of Kenneth and Wong, the competition relation. Because actually they consider this first momentum predictable phase. And there are also numerical computations.
Which paper?
Garrison and Bond.
I'm not so sure it's easy analytically because the optimal state is not easy.
Yes.
The optimal optimal state is not.
Is there something else in the context of position measurements? There's also been work on optimal ways of measuring differences in position.
Uh-huh.
And so perhaps you might get a different answer there. And then if you also see coincidence with the optimal estimation problems, then you'll know that there's the most deep connection.
Yeah. No, but I can write all the equations from head to solve to compare these two. Quantities. It's just a discrete word. Here we got some Schrödinger equation, and if we do the same analysis for the phase operator, we get a discrete Schrödinger equation. So a Schrödinger equation not on L2 of R, but on L2 of N. and so we get, instead of the Laplacian, we get some second order difference operator. And so I think it's not very surprising that the number is very similar, but it's almost equal or maybe equal. That's surprising.
No more questions? All right, let's thank the speaker again.